everybody, it's Mike Jeffers, ChicagoJazz.com, Chicago Jazz Magazine, and welcome to the Talkin' Jazz Podcast. I'm excited to have on, we're actually previewing a show. Justin Robinson is coming into town March 28th through the 31st at the Jazz Showcase. Of course, Jazz Showcase is at 806 South Plymouth Court in Chicago. And obviously, everyone listening to this, I'm sure, has been there. But Justin, is this going to be your first time at the Showcase leading your own group, or have you been there before? I know you've been there with different groups in the past, but is this kind of like your debut leading your own group there?
Yes, it is my debut there as a leader.
That's really
yes, it is.
That's cool. I mean, so let's talk a little bit, because obviously, you know, you're known in the saxophone world, in the jazz world. You've played with a lot of different people, and I want to get into talking about some of your influences and how you came up and all the different people that you actually have worked with in the past. But you've got this new recording, At First Light, which is out on WJ3 Records. You're coming into the Jazz Showcase March 28th through the 31st. Who's in the band, and what can people expect to hear that weekend when you're hitting at the Showcase?
Okay, well, the band will consist of my dear friend Willie Jones III. Marlene will also be on bass. You know, she's a native to Chicago. I mean, well, she lives in Chicago. She's one of the
Marlene Rosenberg. We just had her on a couple of weeks ago. Yep.
Yes, and also Richard Johnson, we'll be featuring a wonderful singer by the name of Renee Neufeld.
Oh, okay.
Who played with Roy's RH Factor, and also she was in a group called Zane, which was a very popular like hip hop R&B group.
Mm-hmm. So, what kind of music is it? I mean, if we're talking about all these different factors, obviously, when I listen to your music, I hear some of your influences, and also reading up a little bit about you, I know you were heavily influenced, obviously, by Charlie Parker, Jackie McLean, kind of straight ahead guys, I think we could say. But, you know, is this new recording kind of melding a lot of different styles together? Little, you know, funky stuff, jazz stuff, straight ahead stuff. What's kind of the feel of the whole thing? Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of a hodgepodge of different things stylistically. Mostly straight ahead. There's a couple of there's one soul thing that I wrote for my wife on the record. But outside of that, the record itself consists of, straight ahead, a lot of my compositions primarily, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, but this project that we're working on is a result of some things that I did concerning Roy's memorial and stuff like that, some of the things that we were reflecting on with some of the guys and people and ladies that were all influenced or worked with Roy in some capacity.
So, yeah. So,
like Marlene played with Roy and that woman's group. I think they did a tour of Japan.
Right, yep.
Willie and I were together and Roy's band for about, I guess, the better part of 6 years. And Renee, of course, you know, she's associated with Roy through the RH Factor and a lot of their creative projects that they did together throughout the years. And also Richard, you know, knew and played with Roy as well. So everybody kind of is connected in a way to Roy.
That's really cool. So, I mean, that the project really is almost a love letter to Roy, right? I mean, in some way where you guys are really
exactly
pulling all that stuff together and pulling all your experiences with them together into one recording.
Yeah, exactly. That's what this will be about. The record At First Light was done a couple of years ago. So it reflects compositionally the things that I was doing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But this band was kind of put together with more of, you know, since things have changed drastically with that in mind for me, you know, like to kind of, you know, do our own thing all together, but in the memory of Roy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you understand what it is, because it's not necessarily a Roy tribute band, like we won't be playing his repertoire, but it's kind of like like a remembrance thing, or you know,
yeah.
I don't know the word I'm looking for.
Yeah. Well, I think I get the gist. I think what you're kind of doing is you know, you played with Roy. All these different people played with Roy, so they all took something from the experience of being with him on the bandstand for years and years and touring and playing a lot. And you guys are all just kind of coming together, and all of those things are going to meld together just because all of you have played with Roy. But you're going to be playing different right. tunes and things like that. But it's going to be like, if you want to go and check something out and you love Roy Hargrove, but you also love, you know, the other people that were in those bands, I think this is a great opportunity to go and check it out. And here's something that you can probably relate back as an audience listener, and you can hear, wow, man, that's now I know where these guys are coming from.
Yes, exactly. That's going to be the focus of the music and the intent of the music. You know, it'll reflect Roy without it necessarily being a Roy repertoire band.
Yeah, yeah. So why don't we talk a little bit about Roy before we get into some of your background and stuff, since we're talking about it now. I mean, how long did you play with Roy? I was just reading up on you. I know you were with him for quite a while, but you were also in his big band as well. So is that all just kind of part of the whole deal when you were playing with Roy for how many years?
I started playing with him officially in 2001. Like somewhere around July, August of 2001, until you know his untimely passing.
Right. So you were in the band all the way up until he passed away. Then
his last gigs. Yeah, his last gig. I was there.
Wow. So what? I always like to find out, because you know, when you get the gig and you're playing with Roy, how did the gig come about? I mean, you know, because you always hear these. Sometimes you hear some crazy story where some guy sitting at home gets a phone call. He gets on a plane, flies somewhere. The next day, he's like on stage with like a famous whoever at a sold out club, and it's the first gig, and it's like thrown into the fire. What was it like? How did you end up getting the gig with Roy and playing with him?
Well, I wasn't sitting at home, but it was almost similar to that. Actually, I was out with little Jimmy Scott, and I saw him. I guess it was 2000. We were down at the New Orleans Jazz Heritage Festival, and he made mention then that hey man, what you been up to and that kind of thing. I said, well, I've been playing with little Jimmy Scott the last few years, and he said, well, let's get together and let's rap. And then I didn't hear anything. I saw them in Perugia when I was there with little Jimmy, and he had a very dear friend of mine as well on saxophone, Jesse Davis, in his band at the time. So I guess Jesse was moving on to do his own projects, which I didn't know at the time. Mm-hmm. So when I got back home, Roy's manager reached out to me, and it was basically like that, like we were. Okay, we wound up doing some festival in Connecticut like 2 days later or something like that. So it was like that, an outdoor festival in front of, hundreds of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like that.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, that's usually how it happens, right? Because all of a sudden, boom, okay. Yeah. Hey man, do you know all these tunes? No. Okay, well, good luck, right? And then
yeah,
you're
exactly.
Playing.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. We hit at one, Oh, do you know these? Do you know this? No. No, do you know that? No. Okay. Well, we hit at one. Yeah.
You had one time through the form, and then you take a solo. Okay, great.
Exactly. Yep.
So So getting into that, when you're coming from playing with little Jimmy Scott and several other artists before that, what was some of the takeaways, like right off the bat, like the first 6 months playing with Roy, like how did that start to all, did it all of a sudden just like, what did you experience? How did it influence your playing at all? Did it give you a new perspective on your playing, listening to him and how he interacted with the band, just being present on stage with that? I mean, how did that work out?
Yeah. It's pretty clear, actually. It's, when I joined, I'd also been, at the time I'd been traveling with the jazz master, little Jimmy Scott, and, his whole thing was, he was one of the great balladeers of that generation. So, a lot of our sets were, beautiful ballads, blues, things like that. So I had to kind of reshape my thinking in order to play with Roy and, that intensity and the fire that he played with, and try to, change my thinking, because my thing was becoming more of a nuanced thing, playing behind, little Jimmy, and then going with Roy, who also had all very lyrical since. So it was kind of in that regard, it was an easy transition. But, you know, the intensity that the band played with at the time, because when I joined, it was Willie Jones, Gerald Cannon, and Larry Willis.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, wow. they had been playing together for some time. So then Dwayne Bernal joined us shortly after. And, you know, he fit right in, coming from Bobby Hutcherson and Roy Haynes and all those guys.
Oh, yeah.
And so you know, it's kind of like, you know, I was thrown into the fire. You know, it's like going into Gleason's gym or something like that. You know?
You know, let's talk a little bit about that, because I know you teach. I think I was reading a little bit, right? You do some lessons when you're in town and things like that, I think, with different students.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you've taught younger musicians, and obviously you're probably around younger musicians because they come out and see you play and stuff like that. But I'm always interested to get an artist's take how difficult it is to play with that kind of intensity, right? Because, I mean, you know, you can go to jam sessions, you can have sessions at your studio, in your house, wherever you want to go, you're learning tunes and stuff. But there's another level of playing with intensity in front of an audience with somebody like Roy, right, specifically.
Yeah.
And then doing it every night. I mean, that's just like, that's something that you can't practice, I don't think. What's your take on that?
No, exactly. You know, that's what, you know, just on the road with, you know, the way that the gigs happen. That's one of the things that I think that, you know, practicing and stuff like that, Roy had one of the best phrases for that. He said, get it all in now, because once you start working, you know, there's no time for practice, because, you know, you're basically flying. Just to give you an example, the first tour that I did with him, like, I was coming from Japan. I came home 2 days or 3 days or whatever, and then went to Europe with him for 5 weeks straight to the showcase from there. So it was like, I guess it was like six or so weeks. But most of the gigs that we did were one-nighters.
Oh, wow. And it was probably every night, right?
The showcase. No, yeah, pretty much, yeah. Like, you look at it, you know, you talk to Larry and ask him, okay, when is, you know, when do we have a day off? Oh, yeah, tomorrow we don't play. But we travel, you know, we got two trains,
yeah.
an airplane to a 4-hour bus ride.
Oh, oh man.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how it is, you know? Too, right? I mean, that's the deal.
Yeah. Last tour that we did was the same deal, you know?
Isn't that, and you know, that's one of the things too. I don't think people understand that, you know, in the jazz world, that's how it is. I mean, you're not,
yeah.
You know, maybe 40 years ago, 30 years ago, you'd go somewhere and you'd be somewhere for a week, 2 weeks, and play somewhere, maybe Birdland or something like that. But nowadays, it's like you have to schedule out your touring schedule so that you can hit all these different places and kind of sync them up. And a lot of times it's one-nighters, and you got enough time to travel to the next city. You get there, and you correct me if I'm wrong, you probably roll in, you check into the hotel, you go right to the club, do a sound check, get your brain together a little bit, and then you're in front of about 300 people.
Yes, that's usually the case. And that's not just for jazz musicians, especially even in the old days, you know, like Ella or the bigger acts, they did a lot of concerts.
Mm.
Like when I first joined Roy's band, we played some clubs in between, like, things, but we did a lot of concerts in Europe, you know, like 2,000 seaters and things like that.
Sure.
You know, because he was at the height of his popularity. You know, the RH Factor had not yet been formed, but he had been out with the Directions and Music.
Yep.
And they had started doing all those things during that time period. So we were playing, like, you know, all these different concert halls.
Oh, wow. And that's another whole level of stuff there, because that's like...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think it's good for younger musicians to hear this too, because, you know, we're talking about the clubs and we're talking about concerts, and those are two different things. I mean, at least to me, because obviously, you know, you're going to put a show on at a club, but it's a different kind of thing than if you're in a concert hall in front of 2,000 people and you have two sets or something, or maybe you have just 1 hour and a half set or whatever's going on. I mean, you have to keep these people's attention, like, dead on the whole time.
Exactly. That's the deal, you know. And they're sitting there. It's not like a club where you order drinks and you know you can walk around or something like that and interact with the people, stuff like that. You know, you're just standing there on stage. It's this cathedral or this old, you know, beautiful concert hall, and you're just playing, you know.
And if you're having an off night, they're sitting there just staring at you like, what is going on?
Oh,
here?
Yeah. Exactly. You start looking like a science experiment or something like that. going awry, you know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background, too, because when did you first kind of get into saxophone and get into, well, I guess let's start with that. How did you get into saxophone? Did you grow up in like a musical household?
Well, my father played saxophone. He was an amateur. He had ideas of becoming a professional until he got to New York and actually heard Jackie McLean and Lou Donaldson and all those guys play live. So he decided to, you know, on another profession. You know, so he, you know, he always, you know, he, you know, him and my mom, they were always very supportive of my endeavors in there. But I got serious about it because as a kid, I was really into martial arts and stuff like that. I was training with the famous older karate black belt in the neighborhood. And so, you know, I was started out from very early in that, and I was, you know, competing, doing tournaments and things like that. And once I started playing the saxophone, I just kind of, that was pretty much consumed my time.
Was that, you was know, that like teenage years or?
Yeah, like I guess I started playing 12, started dabbling with it, 12 or 13. And then we had a wonderful music program at my middle schools at 109. It was Al Steyer was the music director. And a lot of famous musicians went through that school, actually. Graham Haynes, one of the last set of the guys was Marcus Gilmore.
Oh, wow.
Because it was in Hollis, Queens, yeah. And it, I mean, it was in Queens in general, and my, you know, area was like the Queens Village, Hollis area. So like, I went there, you know, like Tom Brown was there. You know, I know I'm missing a lot of names, but those are the guys like Graham Haynes. Well, all of Roy Haynes's kids went through this school, went to this school.
Oh, they all went through there, and because that's where they were growing up then.
Exactly. They were growing up there, and there's also, we had a, you know, nice music program. So O'Brien Carrot is another one. I mean, the list is long for this middle school.
Yeah, so this is like a superstar middle school here that's churning out some serious jazz players and music players throughout the years. You know,
exactly.
Were you in like the jazz band, and they had like a, you know, regular jazz band there and all that?
We had a concert band and the jazz band, and we had a small jazz combo at the time.
Oh wow! Yeah. Wow, for middle school.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
I mean, so, you know, back then, I mean, it was like, it was pretty, you know, pretty intense out there because, you know, the Queens had a pretty big music scene. Also, not, you know, just in the straight ahead jazz, but they had a lot of funk players, a lot of funksters out there as well. And then great players. I believe, if I'm correct, I believe Lenny White grew up out not far from me. You know, it's like a lot of Bernard Wright was from my neighborhood.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like, what was in the water out there, man?
Yeah, exactly. And Marcus Miller and those guys, they were on the other side of the southern side of the area, which was like not far. It's like the other side of that little section of Queens.
Wow.
He went to the other school. There was another great program. I forgot. It was like I can't remember the name of that school, but I think Marcus went there and a bunch of other guys as well.
Wow.
So, you know, and there's... Yeah, so it was like a great local scene. And then, you know, a lot of the pros, you know, they lived in St. Albans, Queens. So, like, Frank West lived there. Walter Perkins, who was a dear friend of mine. Gilly Coggins, who was, like, my father and him were, like, you know, towards the end, were, like, best buddies.
you know,
used to go play pool together and all of that. Yeah.
Isn't that so you were around it like constantly from like your teenage years all the way on, and it sounds to me like, you know, like we're similar age group, you know. So I mean, a lot of people that I came up with in school that weren't in the music scene were listening to like rock and different things like that, and, you know, heavy metal and all that different stuff. I mean, was that stuff that you were listening to as well as jazz, or were you just consumed with the jazz sound?
No, I was totally consumed with jazz. You know, I was totally consumed with Charlie Parker in particular, and of course Jackie McLean, Sonny Stitt. All those guys were my, you know, that's all I wanted to do was play like them. You know what I mean?
So were you learning tunes back then? Like, let's say in high school, I mean, that you're probably learning tunes.
Oh, yeah.
And
no, at high school I was doing gigs already. I was playing with, you know, you know this wonderful drummer. His name is Bernard Hopper.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Cause I was one of the members of the Hopper Brothers band. I joined them when I was like 16 or 17. Yeah.
Wow. Well, there's a learning experience right there.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. So, you know, he was with Betty at the time. So Betty Carter, and the their trio consisted at the time of Mike Bowie, Bernard Hopper, and Benny Green.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you were around that all the time. You were just probably around it all the time.
Exactly. Until Benny left for Art Blakey. Actually, Benny was, I was around him in that situation. You know, we were traveling little cars, going from here to there with Art, making these little gigs and stuff. Yeah.
You ended up, where'd you end up going to college? Did you go to college?
No, not much. I was already playing. Like I said, we were signed with collectively and individually with PolyGram during the time, Verve.
Nice. Yep.
Records, yeah. So you know, I started pretty much playing. I went to the new school for a hot minute, and I was around Pete Yellen quite a bit at the Long Island school, the LIU. So I went there for like 6 months or so, but it was just, you know, I was already starting to get calls, let's go to Europe, let's do this, you know, the record is coming out. So, you know, that kind of thing, you know, Ron Carter produced Wynard's first record. So, you know, was already out there playing on the scene and,
sure,
you know, doing stuff. So it was just, you know, I was like, at the time I was like, why do I want to run up a debt when I'm already working?
You know, and that's one of the things that I think a lot of people, and I mean, you know, I went to North Texas, so I mean, you know, but I left. Yeah. I didn't get it because I realized that you can either play or you can't play. And if you don't want to be a band director, you don't. Nobody ever asked me for a degree to play at a club. So I was like, okay, well, I guess that was it.
Yep.
So you're already in the middle of it. So that makes total sense. I mean, but as like, you know, since we're talking and you probably have, you know, 20 something kids, 18 year old kids, you know, talking to you and emailing you and stuff like that. I mean, what's your, to me, if you want to be a player, it's so expensive to go to college, but to me, I think having a plan, if you go to a, you know, let's say Berkeley or somewhere like that, or North Texas or wherever, you go there with a plan and you know that you're going there for a specific reason. I think that's one thing rather than just saying, okay, I'm going to be a jazz musician and I'm going to college and I'm going to get a jazz studies degree, because there's a lot of debt involved and you're playing, you're on the scene, you're doing stuff. And I think it really just comes down to you can either play or you can't play. So what's your advice to kids that are in high school or just getting out of high school and are looking to be a player, but, you know, not quite sure how to go about it?
Yeah. I mean, of course everybody's journey is going to be different, but my suggestion would be like, you know, a place like, Oberlin, where they have like some of the, you know, greatest musicians in the world teaching there, or, you know, Berkeley, you know, for the same thing. You know, you got Ralph Peterson and guys like as instructors down who are like, you know, international, known, famous, top level guys.
Yep.
It was a lot different when I came along. It was like a lot of the instructors at a lot of the jazz program had never even been in like Art Blakey's band and things like that. So I wasn't as motivated. You know, like, you know, if I was 17 or 18 now and I had a chance to go to Oberlin and be around Gary Bartz, I think I would do it.
Right. Yeah. You're right. That's true. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
That's true. Because you get direct access to a master rather than back when you were coming up. It wasn't quite like that. You were already getting direct access to masters. So why bother going somewhere else?
And also, I grew up in New York, so it was like, you know, I could go to the Cultural Theater and go to Barry Harris's class or see Barry play, you know, and they would have acts there, you know, like a typical act at the Cultural Theater back then was like Junior Cook and Bill Hardman.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Yeah, so, you know,
Isn't that amazing? I mean, you're in it at that moment and you're in it now and stuff. So you don't really think about it. But I mean, at some point you probably just close your eyes, lie down and just think about everybody that you, that you saw that you didn't really, you know, it's like, oh yeah, well this guy's over here tonight and whatever, you know, who cares, you know, but now it's like, oh my God, I can't believe I saw all these guys playing in their prime. Yeah. Most of them too.
I think about that all the time, in particular with Woody Sharp, because he was, around the scene a lot, and like I guess in my formative developmental years, he used to play a regular gig at the West End Cafe.
No kidding.
It's actually where I met Steve Davis. We both sat in with Woody Shaw there.
No kidding.
Years ago. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
You know, Carter Jefferson. So yeah, I see this, you know, go to see this group, like, you know, I'm like 18 years old, go to the West End Cafe and see Woody's group with Stafford James, Victor Lewis, Larry Willis, and Carter Jefferson, you know, and Steve Torre. You know, when the sextet would be there.
Yeah, and it's also, just, and they're there regularly, right? They were just there regularly. Yeah. That was the thing.
Exactly. Wow. And also had the pleasure of meeting a wonderful young saxophone player there when he first joined Woody's band, was Kenny Garrett.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, you know, that's why I first saw and heard him, you know, was with his band.
Wow.
I don't think it was at West End Cafe, though. I think it was at the Culture Theater, it was the Vanguard. It was the Vanguard where I met, Kenny Garrett the first time.
Amazing. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about your compositional stuff, too, because, you're writing tunes. So now the new release, At First Light, on WJ3 Records. And, of course, you can get that at Amazon, CD Baby, all the different spots, iTunes, all that good stuff. Is this primarily all your original music on here?
Yes, the majority of it. And it's also it was guys that I like playing with as well. So it was like some songs that I had been writing, you know, throughout the course of the time with Roy on the road and stuff like that, that I just kind of, because of our road schedule, I never really had a whole lot of time to kind of actually sit down and discuss this particular project. Mm-hmm. Then I finally went to talk with Willie, because I did another one called In the Spur of the Moment some years ago, for Willie Jones as well.
Okay.
For WJ3 Records. And so it'd been a while. I did a lot of fantasy in between, but I said, I got all these new compositions, you know, like you check them out and stuff like that. He's like, man, let's go in the studio. Mm-hmm. He said, who would you like to use? He said he preferred to concentrate on the production part. So he asked me about what drummers, and I said, I really like this guy, Jeremy Dean Clemens. And, you know, the bass player, I mean, Celine had been playing with Roy and I for some years at that point. And then I had a good friend who's originally from Hartford, named Sharp Radway, who's kind of like an unknown, you know, it's like a gym, you know what I mean? He's actually playing with Benny Golson quite a bit now. And, you know, so I was just like, man, these cats would be perfect to do this record with. So, you know, they were all available on this said day, and we wound up knocking everything out in one day.
Wow.
And I'm really, I'm very happy with the product.
So what kind of direction, like what kind of tunes, what kind of compositions? Are these all compositions like kind of based in jazz, but are they straight ahead stuff? Mm-hmm. Is it a mixture of things? What can somebody expect to hear on this kind of a thing?
Actually a little bit of everything, but a lot of the compositions deal with some modern harmony. And then others, like I have one that's like kind of a simple, it's a blues, but not a blues in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
That I wrote for my wife, actually. And, it's called Paula. And, you know, it's more of like something you might hear us play with Roy.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like some of his little R&B ditty type things.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the other stuff is another kind of reflection on, you know, some other influences like Train, like early 60s.
Oh, okay.
Joe Henderson, and things like that. You know, so it has a mixture that I think is kind of unique.
I know it'd be interesting. Mm-hmm. I think I'm always curious myself. How do you go about, I'm sure every tune comes about differently, but I mean, is there a process that you sit down and say, okay, I'm going to sit down and write today, this is what I'm going to do? You have it blocked out because you're in town or you're somewhere where you know it's going to be like, okay, I can really focus on this? Or are these just ideas that you've been picking up playing and coming up with different things here and there, and then you finally just kind of meld them all together?
Usually I come up with the melody first,
mm-hmm.
and try to find the harmony around it, you know, but it's more of a thing of something that has come to me. It's more that than a situation where it's like I plan to write. Like I'm going to sit down, I'm going to write six songs today or something like that.
Right.
But it, you know, they just kind of come to me. And sometimes they do come in bunches like that. But it's not like a premeditated act at all.
Right, right. Yeah, you're not sitting down and planning out from noon until 3 o'clock you're going to write six tunes and put them on an album. But it's probably a very organic process, right? So it takes some time to put all this stuff together.
Yeah, and then also I don't write from the finale or something like that. It's me, it's a pen and pencil, so it's you know, it's a little different. So I do have to sit down and kind of, nowadays I just use like voice memo or something, and I'll, you know, even if I just have some time at the piano, and I'll record it so I don't forget it, and then maybe later on write it out.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that way I don't forget it, you know.
I wonder if we should explain to our younger listeners what a pencil is, but no, I'm just kidding. So you guys, so you knocked this whole thing out, and it's now just out. You're coming to the Jazz Showcase March 28th through the 31st. I mean, it's going to be a killing show. And, you know, just hearing your background and hearing about how you worked with Roy, I love the concept of what you're going to be doing at the Showcase with all the different people that have performed with Roy here and there. But obviously, you guys are all using your own voices, so it's not going to be a tribute thing, but kind of an homage to working with him. And you know, as far as everybody listening now and all that stuff, do you have other gigs? Because obviously this is online and it's a podcast, so I mean, obviously the Showcase is March 28th through the 31st, but do you have anything else after that that we should mention so that people, if they're not in Chicago, might be able to catch you?
Oh yeah, well I'm leaving next week for Israel. Doing Haifa Jazz Festival. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It's a tribute to Max Roach, playing with a great pianist by the name of Tamir Hindelman, and also Sylvia Cuenca. I don't know if you know her. She's a great drummer.
No.
She's also on the gig. Yeah.
Oh wow.
And So, but after the Showcase, I have I'm doing these like the first Tuesdays of each month with my own band at Smalls.
Oh, that's cool.
A featured, kind of artist in residence thing. So, like, it'd be like first week of April, May, that kind of thing.
So it's the first Tuesday, and the cool thing with Smalls is that people can see the stream online too. They can subscribe,
exactly.
And they can watch the thing online, which I love. I mean, that's like it's one of those things that I don't understand why more clubs are. I think some are starting to pick it up, but Smalls has been doing it forever, and they have a great feed and it's a great sound and all that stuff. So if you are in Chicago, you can still check out Justin and his group. So it's Tuesdays, basically the first Tuesday of every month.
The first one, though, will be actually on March 12th when I return from Israel.
Oh.
So the very first live one will be March 12th at Smalls.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. That's perfect. All right, well, I'll tell you what. Mm-hmm. We're gonna close this out, but, man, it's been fascinating. I'm so glad that we talked, and I'm so glad we could preview this show coming up. So Justin Robinson, is it a sextet, septet, quartet? I can't remember. I'm sorry.
It'll be a quintet featuring Renee Neufeld.
Okay. Perfect. So that's coming up March 28th through the 31st, Jazz Showcase. Of course, it's 806 South Plymouth Court, jazzshowcase.com for advanced tickets, which I would suggest you get. And of course, on Sundays, it's the Joe Siegel Save the Children matinee. So that's at 4 p.m. They always have that Sunday matinee, which is great. 12 and under get in free. And that's a really cool thing. And I know you must have played that a million times with Roy over the years, and it's probably always shocking how many people show up to that with their kids. I mean, it's great, you know.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you walk in and it's just like this overwhelming amount of children just right there waiting, staring at you. Yeah.
Well, so anyway, so all the information's there. And Justin, man, I really appreciate you jumping on here talking jazz. And we look forward to seeing you here in Chicago very soon.
I look forward to being here.
Awesome.
Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Definitely. All right. Thanks, Justin. And for everybody listening, we will keep you up to date on what's happening. And thanks for listening. And check out all the information at ChicagoJazz.com and ChicagoJazzMagazine.com.